1 year ago today, President Obama signed one of the few bipartisan bills enacted in his administration so far. It was called the Serve America Act. This law creates more volunteer opportunities and triples the size of the AmeriCorps National Service Program. But the money is just starting to trickle out, as NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
A group of middle school students waded yesterday morning in a small stream in Northern Virginia.
Oh, the water's seeping into my shoes.
They were there to test the quality of the water by seeing what kinds of insects they could find. Later, they're supposed to come up with a project to help fix problems they uncover, such as pollution. Jessica Brommelkamp, with a nonprofit group called Earth Force, helps the students sort through what they've collected in their nets.
If you just kind of look through the leaves, just pick stuff up. Oh, here it is.
There's something. There's a little buggy.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, we got another worm.
This summer, Brommelkamp will do similar work with disadvantaged middle schoolers as part of a program called Summer of Service. It was created by the Serve America Act and gives participants up to $500 for college. Jean Manny is with Innovations in Civic Participation, a group that spearheaded the idea. She says the goal is to teach at-risk kids how to become active in their communities.
We're also looking at leadership skills and trying to promote academic skills, too, in terms of public speaking and critical thinking and literacy.
But Summer of Service is the only program created by the Serve America Act for which grants have been awarded so far. Several others are just getting off the ground. For example, $50 million has been set aside to fund nonprofits with innovative ideas for solving social problems. But that money won't go out until June. Patrick Corvington is the new head of the Corporation for National and Community Service. He says it takes time to get the ball rolling, and his agency is still on track to triple the number of AmeriCorps slots to 250,000 over the next 8 years.
We'll meet those numbers because people want to serve. We're seeing a record increase in the number of organizations who are applying for more AmeriCorps members. We're seeing a record numbers of young people who want to become engaged in service.
In fact, the agency says applications for AmeriCorps have tripled over the past year. Corvington says even more importantly, he's seen a new attitude about volunteering and national service.
I have to confess that in my early parts of my career, I was one of those who thought, volunteers, well, I guess I'll have them stuff some envelopes and do those kind of things. When I talk to executive directors today, they see volunteers as a critical resource for them.
He says the Serve America Act encourages such thinking among nonprofits seeking government grants. It's also pushing them to do a better job measuring the impact of their work. But how all this plays out remains to be seen, says Howard Husick of the Manhattan Institute, which advocates free market thinking. He says the $50 million Social Innovation Fund, for example, could identify creative nonprofits as models for the rest of the country.
Those can start to become the new normal for hidebound, bureaucratized federal programs. The danger is that these bright young stars are themselves going to get captured and become bureaucratized.
He also worries about the impact on the nonprofit world of the government deciding who gets all these new AmeriCorps volunteers. But like others, he's still waiting to see how the new law is actually put into effect. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
We're also following the battle between the Wall Street firm Goldman Sachs and the Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC has filed fraud charges against Goldman, and both sides have a lot at stake here. For Goldman, there's a long history with a mostly clean regulatory record. For the SEC, the case is a chance to show if it can keep up with changing markets. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has our report.
Trying to understand the financial crisis left us with a new lexicon of terms hardly anyone can explain. Credit default swaps, synthetic collateralized debt obligations. More generally, some people call them exotic instruments. Exotic as in complicated. For the SEC, prosecuting potential fraud involving investments like these is, to put it simply, hard.
They will only be able to pick off a handful of these because of the time it takes and the money it takes.
That's Lynn Turner, former chief accountant for the SEC, whose work included forensic tracking of money.
Typically, the SEC has been an agency of many attorneys who are not always well-versed in the business operations and transactions of Wall Street.
And Turner says it requires lots of financial knowledge even to know where to look for possible fraud. And once you identify something fishy, then the process involves extensive depositions, downloading hard drives, and going through millions of emails.
It just takes incredible time and an incredible number of staff. It takes very highly qualified forensic and computer experts. That's very expensive, very time-consuming.
And the SEC's opponents, in this case Goldman Sachs, have tons of resources to match them. The SEC suffered some big missteps with high-profile cases involving Bear Stearns and Bernard Madoff, and it's mindful of its challenges. So now the agency is boosting its policing of this new area because it's their job to make sure investors have faith in the markets. Earlier this year, the agency created new teams within its enforcement bureau with expertise in some of these complex financial products. Robert Kuzami is director of that bureau. The SEC declined to offer him for an interview, but last month Kuzami spoke to the Society of American Business Editors and Writers. He said that Wall Street firms sometimes use the complexity of products to conceal misconduct.
So the only way to catch these people is to be smart in the areas that they operate.
He says here, so the only way to catch them is to be smart in the areas that they operate. But then there's the added challenge of winning the case if it goes to court. And there, experts say, the SEC faces more obstacles. First, it needs to explain how these investments work to a jury. And then prosecutors need to prove definitively that the defendant broke the law. Take the Goldman case. The bank allowed one of its clients to structure an investment even as that client was betting against it. Goldman's actions may seem unethical, but that's not the legal issue here. It's whether Goldman should have disclosed a possible conflict of interest that's the problem. Peter Henning is a professor and former attorney in the SEC Enforcement Division. He says with these new products, there's no single standard for what is proper disclosure.
Disclosure is not the same in every case. The buyers of this security were not mom-and-pop investors. These weren't people in off the street. These were large financial institutions with their own ability to analyze the underlying security and the risks involved.
Indeed, in a conference call yesterday, Goldman Sachs said the investors understood the risks involved. Goldman's general counsel also said those investors knew that other investors would be betting against them. That's just the way the game works. Henning says these newfangled financial products didn't even exist when he was at the SEC, and he admits he just barely understands them. So he doesn't envy the SEC's task of going after Goldman Sachs. He's also grateful he doesn't live in Manhattan, where the jury would be picked if the case goes to trial.
I would not want to sit in the courtroom and listen to this testimony because it's going to put a lot of people to sleep.
Goldman Sachs said yesterday the case appears to be heading to court. It has not, however, ruled out the possibility of a settlement. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
The financial information on American Airlines is not inconclusive at all. They're still in trouble. Just yesterday, Delta Airlines announced quarterly losses of about $250 million, which actually was not as bad as many people had anticipated. NPR's Kathy Lohr has more.
The airline business has been tough. The recession dramatically slowed traffic. February blizzards forced U.S. airlines to cancel thousands of flights. And now fallout from the Icelandic volcano stopped all traffic in and out of northern Europe for days. But there is some good news.
For U.S. carriers, it'll be a relatively short-term hit.
Michael Boyd is president of Boyd Group International, an aviation consulting firm.
We think right now they're down about $80 million in terms of lost revenue. And they're down domestically about 80,000 passengers that would have been flying domestically but aren't because they can't get here.
Delta announced volcano-related disruption grounded about 400 flights as of Monday at a cost of $20 million in lost revenue. But compare that to the recent snowstorms when the airline canceled 7,000 flights and lost $65 million in revenue. The disruption has created uncertainty for customers, but analysts say U.S. airlines won't face as many costs as you might think. They're not flying in extra planes to handle the stranded passengers because airline analyst Robert Mann says companies simply don't have them.
Airlines run a very lean operation now, so since there are no spare aircraft or crews, the airlines will attempt to maximize loads on every one of their aircraft that do fly, but it may take days or in some cases a week or so to get some of these customers to where they want to go.
Airlines are still selling tickets on future flights and will accommodate those whose flights were canceled as best they can. That likely means more waiting and rerouting passengers to other U.S. cities to get them back home. Mann says the lost revenue will be offset in part, as carriers do not use costly fuel when planes sit idle on the ground.
It's not the equivalent of looking at an ever-rising cost of fuel. We're talking about a four-day event, and that's the extent of it.
U.S. airlines will refund some tickets and pay to house dislocated crew members, but analysts say they don't pay much to disrupted passengers when flights are delayed or canceled due to storms, volcanoes, or other acts of God. Still, it's going to take some time for all the airlines to get back on track.
You know, there are all sorts of problems people don't even think about.
Airline industry analyst John Pinkavage.
Anytime you disrupt the system, you're going to add extra costs. Because, for example, you've totally messed up your entire crew scheduling system. Now you're going to get down toward the end of the month, and even if you have the airplanes available, you may not have the people.
Still, the economic impact on U.S. airlines will not be nearly as bad as the effect on European carriers that have been virtually shut down. U.S. airlines are looking forward to a stronger summer travel season and the hope of profitability in the second quarter. As a cloud of volcanic ash dissipated, the first flights began taking off from Britain's airports last night. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today, the Senate moved one step closer to regulating trading in derivatives. Derivatives are those complex financial instruments that were at the heart of the financial collapse 2 years ago. The Agriculture Committee approved the measure by a vote of 13-8. One Republican, Charles Grassley of Iowa, voted with the Democrats.
Meanwhile, the Senate Banking Committee is hard at work to finish its broader financial reform legislation. This morning, White House economic advisor Lawrence Summers talked about financial regulations. In an interview at his West Wing office, Summers described the bill under discussion as the most comprehensive reform of financial regulation in more than 60 years. As for the revival of the bill's chances and of Republican interest in negotiating on a bill, Lawrence Summers says that doesn't just reflect last week's news of an SEC civil complaint against Goldman Sachs. He says it reflects far longer-term considerations.
Financial reform is an issue that brings the American people together. There is no one satisfied with the status quo. There is almost no one who believes that the major danger is that Wall Street will not be able to take enough risk. And therefore, there's a very strong commitment to standing up for the public interest against the special interests.
It sounds to me you're saying the Republicans have likely reconsidered their political position on the same bill.
I will let the Republicans speak for themselves. For us in the White House, the matter is very clear. This is about a foundation for future prosperity, and even more fundamentally, it's a test of the ability of our government to stand up for the public interest against the strongest and most highly paid and most willing to spend special interests.
I'm sure you heard former President Clinton's remarks the other day when he was asked about regulating derivatives. Back when he was in the White House, he said on that score, he was wrong to have followed the advice of you and your predecessor at Treasury, Robert Rubin. In those days, you were against regulating derivatives. Did you have it wrong back in the 1990s?
Much has changed. The credit default swap market didn't even exist in the mid-1990s, and that's the center of our trouble. I have consistently been for transparency, consistently been for clearinghouses, consistently emphasized the need for legal certainty in this area. And there's no question in the context of current conditions that we need far stronger oversight. We need far more reliance on clearinghouses. What are, you know, people don't really know what a clearinghouse is.
But you're saying that the derivatives market has changed.
Taxpayers being on the hook if someone fails, their counterparties, their partners in a clearinghouse will be on the hook.
If derivatives are regulated in an open exchange, as you say, counterparties would be on the hook, not taxpayers. But Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, says depending on what these new regulations do, the cost to his bank could be between $700 million and $1 billion. Are their customers going to be on the hook for that? That is, will we all pay more in fees to our banks to cover the added costs that the banks will face for trading in these new areas?
If you look
at
the market value of the major financial institutions, if you look at the levels of compensation that they're able to provide their employees, many cases, people over $10 million, I don't think there's any question that they can absorb the costs of providing for safety and soundness without passing it on to consumers who need to borrow money or depositors who deposit in those banks.
But there's a difference between whether those institutions can afford to absorb those costs or whether they will opt to absorb those costs and try instead to pass them on to their customers.
You look at the derivatives market, the participants in those markets are overwhelmingly the largest financial institutions. So it may be that there'll be some passing on to consumers, but the consumers in those markets are the largest financial institutions. And so, yes, if they bear more costs because there's no longer reliance on implicit government insurance, that is as it should be.
I want to ask you what you made of an argument that William Cohan wrote about in a column on the op-ed page of the New York Times yesterday. He described this as obscene. He says the big banks are borrowing money from the Federal Reserve at an interest rate of about 0.5%, and they're buying treasury bills at about 3%, making money off the government, and keeping interest rates so low that people who were saving, who were depositing with them, can barely make any money by doing so. Is something wrong with that picture? Is there something wrong with it that would be changed by the financial regulation bill?
If the financial regulation bill had been in place, we would have a more stable financial system. We would be much less likely to confront a period like the present one. So the financial regulation bill would make an emergency like the present one less necessary. I do believe that in an emergency of this kind that we have avoided, and it is a great credit to Chairman Bernanke, and it is a great, great credit to the policies that the president adopted when he became president 15 months ago. Zero interest rates were a part of that. They were the right thing to do, but they wouldn't have been necessary if we had acted to prevent the disease.
I know you're pretty optimistic about the economic indicators right now. When does the emergency end? When are we out of the shadow of the crisis?
You know, when a patient has a heart attack, the sense of a major medical problem doesn't go off like a light switch. It recedes. That's the process that we're in.
Do you see it receding right now?
Right now, and we're surely in a period of much less risk than the period 6 months ago. But we obviously have a long way to go. We have a statistical recovery, but still a human recession. And no one can declare any kind of victory as long as 15 million people are unemployed.
And in terms of the problem that Mr. Cohan described of almost free money at the Fed for banks who then can actually make money by buying trade, when is that emergency
passed? It's a good try. We in the administration have a very consistent policy, and it's contributed to success over time of respecting the independence of the Federal Reserve and neither trying to predict nor prescribe the Federal Reserve's behavior in setting interest rates.
Lauren Summers, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
Thank you.
Lauren Summers is Director of the National Economic Council and Assistant to the President for Economic Policy.